Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Paul, let me tell you, today I am most excited about our show with our very special guest, Tim Timmons, a man that shaped the fundamentals of my Christian belief system so profoundly that I still follow the precepts he taught me almost 40 years ago. Now, I'd like to ask the listeners to forgive me for the about-to-come longer-than-usual introduction, but it is necessary to establish a context for our conversation with Tim. In 1980, as a man leaning more toward atheism than any other faith system, I found myself in a challenge that required me to read a couple of books in the Bible as a means to disprove the precepts of Christianity. So I read the Gospel of John and St. Paul's letter to the Romans. That's always the one you give to unbelievers or new believers. It's so difficult to understand letter to the Romans. And in the process, especially of reading the Gospel of John, I discovered an almost conversion experience just by reading the text. The Spirit of God led me to realize that there was really something to this Jesus thing. I was overwhelmed by the person of Jesus, his goodness, and his godness. Very shortly after that experience, my sister told me about an Easter sunrise service that was held at the John Wayne Tennis Club in Newport Beach. Now, I knew if I entered the halls of a church that walls would fall in. So I said, a tennis court is safe. So I went to that tennis court and listened to an enormously powerful speaker that spoke of the same kind of Jesus that I had been reading about. After that message was done, Jesus owned me. I wholeheartedly gave myself over to his grace and love. Now, that speaker was our guest today, Tim Timmons, who soon thereafter became my spiritual mentor, and as I said earlier, my life has never been the same since. Since that day, Timmons became the founding pastor of a church of close to 15,000 people called South Coast Community Church, of which I became a minister after completing 3 years of seminary. Today, Tim Timmons is a much different kind of Christian leader after having been exposed in the late 80s to Doug Coe and a group called The Family, a discreet group of Christian influencers with a profound impact on Washington, D.C. and around the world, but it includes congressmen and presidents in D.C. In fact, as we sit here today in September 2019, last month, Netflix aired a 5-episode documentary titled The Family, which has become surprisingly popular and naturally somewhat controversial. So, enough of that long introduction. Let's talk to Tim about his relationship with the family and how it has profoundly influenced his life. Tim, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. It's good to be here.
It's really great to have you. I'm so excited. I'm unusually excited about this interview because you have played such a remarkable influence in my life. And you know, as I thought about it, it is long lasting. Can you believe it's been over 40 years that we've known each other?
No, that is amazing. Yeah, it really is amazing.
Neither one of us are old enough for that.
No, for sure.
I don't know how that happened.
That's right.
We've not always been in contact, but always in spirit. Publicly, I want to thank you and the leading of God for your influence in my life. And after 40 years, your teaching is still with me.
That's very cool. It's just nice that anybody remembers anything from 1 week to the other. And 40 years is really pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that was a wonderful decade. Yeah, you know, seminary for me, the start of South Coast Community Church, you know, the first meeting at 200 people. And then within the first year, we had 2,000, and then we blink our eye, and we're at 12,000 to 15,000.
Yes, it was a great season. Great season.
It really was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people found such solace and such hope in Jesus under your teaching. And that you really were one of the first to dismiss religiosity and institutional religion.
That's interesting that you say it that way. And what's cool is we've not talked about this for all those years. And for you to say those kinds of things just warms my heart big time, because I think that's really the issue. I think what people were buying into was an attitude. It was an attitude that I had about God, about myself, about people. And I think when they bought into that attitude, it was just like their attitude. They just never thought Jesus could be part of that. And so to me, religiosity, getting rid of that. Today we call it Jesus without religious baggage, or Jesus without a halo. You know, think about it.
I like that.
Jesus, I mean, most people have seen pictures of Jesus with a halo. Now, can you follow that guy? Can you get close to that guy? You might get knocked out by the halo. So I realized why I was so turned off with that for so long. But I think that's really cool, that without religiosity, that's the issue.
Yeah, and I think you're right about the attitude, that there was this warmness and general acceptance and there was a vulnerability and a realness to it. You know, it wasn't manufactured.
Yeah,
there was something that was very genuine and very, very warming to people. That's why it grew so quickly.
Yeah. Well, you're very kind to even remember. I'm glad your brain still remembers, but your compliments are great. I know this isn't my show, but I gotta say something. I never will forget. Not after you graduated from seminary, but you were still in it. You'd come back in December, and I was always dreading that you would come back in December because I knew they had drilled you with all kinds of crazy stuff. And so you would kind of, when we finally would meet, you'd start quizzing me on everything. And it was the seminary quiz. I mean, I knew what was coming. But you said something to me one day that I've never forgotten. You knew a couple that I just counseled, and you were talking to me about that, and you said, "You really care about their marriage, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah. I mean, you're not trying to just get them to Jesus. You really care." I said, "Yeah, I do." And I'll never forget the wonder on your face. And it kind of empowered me to say, "Yeah, I really do care." Because I think that's the real problem with religiosity. We want everybody to look good, feel good, sound good, smell good. But if you care, then it's messy. There are a lot of messy things out there. And you care enough to say, "Hey, I do care that you get through this. Now let's get on with it." To me, that's real. That's the real stuff, you know?
I love that. It reminds me of something I was told by the abbot of an abbey in Valyermo, St. Andrew's Abbey. And the abbot was talking about Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "You evangelicals believe in messianic theology. We Catholics believe in messy theology."
That's very cool.
Yeah, that was great. He says life is messy, and it is messy, and that's the beauty of a genuine. Oh, I don't know how I use the word genuine. That's so latent with religiosity baggage, but that is so real. A Christianity that is down in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
I used to talk about the prophets as being dirty prophets. Their feet were dirty.
Yes.
They were on the earth. They weren't walking in on air.
Mm-hmm.
They were experiencing life as it really was. And that, I think that has to do with South Coast Community Church's success at the time.
Mm, that's cool. That's neat.
So in the late 1980s, things were going swimmingly at South Coast Community Church, and then you quietly informed the pastoral staff that you had met a man named Doug Coe and The Family, which is this Netflix series is about, and you talked about their influence on Washington, D.C. We were all interested, and then you never talked about it again. You talked about it in one staff meeting, and then you never talked about it again. What was that all about?
You know, I really don't know. I mean, when you said that the other day, I thought, wow, did I stop? did I go secret? But I just found there was something about that group of people in D.C., it was first called the Fellowship House, and they didn't get into the family till a little later, calling it that way, but everybody's a friend, and we want you to be one of our friends type of deal. Couldn't join anything, nothing to join, and I just couldn't get over how these people were just about Jesus. And Doug Coe just continued to blow me away like he just had breakfast with Jesus that morning. It was so fresh. It was so great. And here we are making up all kinds of things and complicating Christianity, and he's trying to simplify it all. And so I just found an unusual sense of that simplicity. So I really went in to learn. I went to learn and learn and learn because I couldn't. I never met people like that. Because it seemed like everything I knew about was so complicated. You go to seminary, you learn all this amazing stuff that nobody really cares about, and you learn how to complicate everything. But Doug didn't do that. He had a very simplistic way about it. And then the people that were marked by that group, they had the same kind of thing. I remember one guy said, we went to a retreat years ago in Aruba, I think, and one of the guys got up to say, you know, God's only interested in one thing. Are you interested? Are you really interested? If you're interested, then come on in. And I started thinking, well, that's Jesus' marketplace. His marketplace, he's looking for people who are interested, who have ears to hear and eyes to see. Now, that doesn't mean millennials. It doesn't mean old people. It means anybody. So to me, that opened up a whole new world for me to think in terms of that. I used to say at the big church that, look, we had pastors would come in for luncheons or whatever. They wanted me to give them the holy formula, and I had none. We have announcements like they had announcements. We had music like they had music. We did the whole thing like everybody else did. It was an attitude. It really was. But I would say to them, you know, here's the deal. You guys are so interested in building numbers. We don't care. We don't even have a membership here.
Yeah, never counted. We never knew how many people were really there.
It blew their minds when you'd say that kind of thing. And then they'd start asking questions. What would happen if people left? Well, then they would leave and there'd be seats for other people. You know, that's how it would work. But nobody really believed that, I don't think, at first. But I think that was the attitude that was there. We want to help. We want to serve. But we're certainly not interested in growing something. I would go out in the middle of the courtyard in between services, wondering if anybody was going to show up the next service. Because that's kind of how I grew up. My mom, dad, they said, you know, you appreciate everything you get. And I remember our administrator at the time, Rob, he would see me out there, and he felt so bad. He put his arm around me and said, let's go get some coffee. He knew that I was standing here worried if anybody was going to show. Well, they just kept showing, you know. So it was pretty
yeah,
cool.
After a while, that went away because they did keep showing. You know, you talked about Doug Coe's simplicity and there really is something very simple to the gospel message. There really is something to Jesus that is utterly profound, life-changing, not just life-changing, life-altering. It gives us so much, but it really is. It just boils down to believing that Jesus can do what he says he can do.
Yeah, and trusting him. Trusting him that if you watch him long enough, you say, well, I can trust him. He didn't beat anybody up. He's only upset with the super spiritual, and I can't.
Yeah, that's all he ever went after.
That's all. That's it.
That's all he ever went after.
There's something so simple about the fact, too, that he didn't care about people's culture. He didn't want them to change their culture. I think there are 7 cases where he dealt with people from other cultures. He never said, look, when you get back there in Rome, get into a good synagogue. He never said that. He didn't say, watch out for those other gods out there. Be careful of that. No, it was all about his relationship with them, period. Well, that's pretty simple, you know. But we don't like that. We'd like to add on a little bit to that.
Yeah, and it is about relationship, isn't it?
It is.
And it's relationship with him and with other people complicit in this.
Yes.
In this faith system.
Exactly.
So tell me, you know, you had a deep relationship with the fellowship or the family and Doug Coe. Did that impact your ministry at South Coast?
Yeah, I think it did. I think it, you know, before I ever agreed to be pastor, I didn't want to be pastor of anything. Let's start there.
I know.
I was there under duress, and about every 6 weeks I'd tell the people, look, I don't know how much longer I got to be here. I'm here under duress. God's got me here. Let's keep moving until he sends me someplace else. I didn't want to be pastor. So what I wanted to do is try to figure out what are their needs. That was very important. And you know that when you came back in to be a pastor there, you had some, I forget what you were, Leviticus, I think. You wanted to teach Leviticus. And I said, oh, okay. So you told me about what you want to do with Leviticus. And I said, that's a great idea. What about their needs? He said, well, we'll get to that. And about, I think, 6 or 7 weeks into it, he said, tell me about the needs again. I said, well, ask them what their needs are, right? So I was always after people's needs, and how do we meet those needs? And how does Jesus get articulated into that? I grew in that over the years. I knew I didn't want to be super religious, but I didn't know Jesus that well either. I didn't understand. I knew a lot about him. I knew that he was the only one that seemed to be worth following, but I grew in that over the years. So as I would test things out with the people, always had a men's group where I was testing things out. That was very important to me. I knew that the small group thing worked because that's how South Coast started. We started with 20 small groups, and that really worked. And the guy that was the head of small groups that you know, he came to me about 2 months after he'd been hired and said, I don't think I'm a small groups man. I said, oh, hold on. We moved you in here. You're being paid. I'm not. And you're not the head of, you don't like small groups? He said, well, no, I think I'm a speaker. I said, well, that's why when I'm away, you'll speak. He said, I want to speak more than that. I said, well, how much do you want to speak? This is our first year. He said, 50%. He did that to negotiate. I knew that. And I had married them. I knew him well. So I said, okay, you're on. He said, hold up, wait a minute. You're not going to negotiate? I said, no way. He said, why? I said, you want 50% of the time? You and I will share the pulpit on Sunday morning 50% of the time. He said, that's never been done to start a church. I said, I know. Apparently, we're going to be the first. He said, 50% of the time? I said, that's what you wanted, isn't it? Well, yeah. I said, then you're on. He said, why are you doing this? I said, because you're so screwed up. You think churches are grown by the show on Sunday morning. It's not true. Churches are grown through small groups. I had enough sense back then to realize that. And so he came along with me and spent a year. He couldn't stand the pressure after that. But the point is, the small groups really make it work. I always had that sense. Then I watched this with Co and the family and these this fellowship. They were into small groups. Smaller is better. The power of the few. And I began to see, boy, that's it. But I wasn't quite practicing it personally. I had a few guys always in my life, but at the same time, I didn't quite get it until finally moving through that whole time. But yeah, it had a major influence and a major influence on how I taught, trying to be more simple, trying to get back to just that simplicity of what Jesus was all about, you know?
How would you describe that simplicity?
I call it this way. I say, I want to be Jesus-centered, Jesus-sourced, and Jesus-sensitive. And I was working on a video with my wife the other day, and I realized that that's what we want to do. I want to ask Jesus what he thinks about. You remember we used to have that WWJD, what would Jesus
right,
do?
Right, right.
Asking the question, you already had the answer. So it's kind of a cool little deal. But what I started doing with people was saying, have you asked Jesus about this yet? When they asked me a question. Well, they didn't want to ask Jesus. They wanted me, the guru. They wanted the counselor. They wanted the shrink. And so it's ask Jesus what he thinks about that. Pray about it. Come back and let's talk about it. I'm telling you, many times people come back and they had the answer. I'm thinking, there must be something to this. And to me, that's how I move through everything. People would come to me and say, what do you think about the gays? Well, let me ask you this. What do you think? What do you think about the, well, they'd grumble. What do you think Jesus would say about it? Well, he'd love them. Maybe we should love them. You know, I'd always go right back to that because I knew I could count on Jesus to come through. Everything else, once you add anything onto Jesus, you complicate, you divide. All of a sudden, we've got a fight on our hands. We're going to have an argument. I don't want that. I want what's going to unite us. So we found that everywhere with Muslims, Buddhists, doesn't matter where. Jesus always unites unless they think Jesus is a Christian. If they believe Jesus is a Christian, that he founded Christianity and all that, then they think you're out to convert them. So that's why I had to get rid of that. So we started describing Jesus without religious baggage. That's a different kind of Jesus. Jesus without a halo. Oh, wow, that's interesting. So we just grew in that. I mean, it took a long time to figure that, all that out, but and I still am growing in it. I can't get over how we're seeing things I should have seen a long time ago, I feel. But I graduated from a seminary that we were supposed to have all the answers. Right. So I thought I did, and then I found out I didn't.
Right.
What a horrible mess that was.
Well, not really, because what it did is what you did with it, rather than adopting that, you noticed that there was a brokenness to that strategy. And what I've heard you say thus far that I'm really impressed with is that you focus on asking questions.
Yes.
Rather than giving answers, asking questions. What do you think? What are your needs?
That's right.
What would Jesus say? Letting people get their minds in gear and their souls in gear and their hearts in gear.
And as you remember, that's how I did about every message. I started with a question. And that was the way I hooked them in. And then I'd let them answer. They'd answer, oh, that's good, not quite it. But it got them engaged.
Yeah.
I broke that invisible wall. And then I spent the next 35, 40 minutes trying to answer that question. At the end, I'd have a big idea that answered the question. And they stayed with me the whole time because we're all working on this question together. To me, that inductive approach is so much better than what I grew up with the
right.
deductive approach.
Right.
Let me learn you on this, you see.
Yeah,
something
and
about
believe
that.
What I say.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Eugene Peterson. No, it wasn't Eugene Peterson. It was, I can't remember his name. He's Episcopalian. Said, we need more firsthand faith than secondhand believers.
Yes.
Because we have secondhand believers, or people that had just been told what to believe, and they just believe that without question it. We mm-hmm. need firsthand believers, firsthand faith.
That's right.
That it is mine, and it belongs to me. I own it. I believe it, and I'm going to live by it.
That's right. And you step over all those who interpreted that for you
right.
in your world
right.
and found it out for yourself. And for some reason, I had this penchant to go after that. I've always been willing to be a learner. I don't know everything. I thought I did for about a year, and then a little blood and guts will do that in right away. And then I start asking those questions, and I knew a lot of stuff that I believed didn't work. And you know what's interesting? I got a call from the Vatican 4 or 5 years ago. It was a Skype call. I knew the guy who was calling me, but he looked like somebody died, and I didn't know what the world was going on. And so I talked to him through an interpreter, and I said, what happened? He said, I've just seen a miracle. I said, well, what's the miracle? He said, well, I've just been with Pope Francis, and a cardinal has read one of your books, and he gave it to Francis, and he told Francis, this guy believes what you believe. He's not into religiosity, but he's not Catholic. Well, Francis got excited, and he said, well, let's invite him to bring a group here for a private audience in my apartment. So I said, what? He said, I know. Is this amazing or what? It is amazing, for sure. So anyway, we ended up taking 24 people there. We didn't seek it, but it was only because we'd stayed in that questioning, constant questioning about who is Jesus and what did he really say here? If you do that, I think you come up with the right answer over and over and over again. So they had us bring senators and congressmen. They had us bring business people and the head of a Christian colleges. And they wanted people from Africa. I knew people who loved Jesus there and believed the same way we did. They wanted the biggest pastor in the United States. And I thought, oh, that's going to be a tough one because I used to be one of those. And ego is a real issue. And so my wife said, why don't we go after Joel Osteen? I said, I don't know Joel Osteen. Well, let's try to find him. So I knew a guy who worked with him, and I called him up. I said, is there any way you think Joel Osteen would go with me for a private audience to meet the Pope? He said, I'm sure he would, but when is it? And I told him, he said, oh, he can't go that week. He said, he's at Yankee Stadium. I said, well, would you ask him? He said, Tim, he's at Yankee Stadium that week. I said, I know, but what's the problem? He said, well, you have all this media. I said, would you ask him? That's all I'm asking you. Would you ask him? Yeah, don't know, yeah, but ask him. So he promised me he would ask him. 15 minutes later, I get a call back from Joel saying, I'm in.
Now, of course.
Unbelievable. I mean, you know, that's right.
How could a guy say, no, I'm going to Yankee Stadium. I don't want to meet the Pope.
Exactly. I mean, so we went then on to, they wanted, 2 weeks before we went, they asked if we knew any people in Israel who were followers of Jesus like we are. I said, well, yes. Well, could you ask them to go? So I called them. Everybody we asked came. It was just unbelievable. So we met cardinals, archbishops. We took Doug Coe with us. He did not want to go. He was not well. And we worked him hard, took his two sons, and we went together. And I'm telling you, what an experience. It was amazing. Each of the cardinals and the archbishops, they'd tell us what they do. And they'd say, what can we do for you? And they said, would you pray for me? Each one of them. So we'd pray for these guys with the beanie and all the paraphernalia, and they would weep. We'd pray for them, and they would weep. I mean, it was just that kind of thing all the way through. Very humble, amazing experience. Then we got to the Pope himself, who was very, very down to earth, very real. And at one point in time, when we went in to see him, there were five of us who got to go see him first. And when I went in, you know, I'm not at lack for words, but as I walked in, I'm sure he sensed that this guy didn't know what to say. And so he leans into me as he shakes my hand. He says, just call me brother. I said, okay, brother. It was that kind of warmth, you know, that was there. But it was all in unity around Jesus. And then I got to introduce him to Muslims who were followers of Jesus. He would never have met anybody like that.
Right.
And so, you know, Jesus means everything to us because that's our open door to everyone in the world. We never had pushback on that.
And that is really the focus of Doug Coe, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, that's really the influence. Would you say that's the influence of Doug Coe in your life?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I heard on the video that the family prefers to call themselves followers of Jesus instead of Christians.
Uh-huh.
And we I think we've already covered that, but I'd like you to do that specifically. What is that all about, followers of Jesus as opposed to Christians?
Well, no one in the family that I ever met said, don't call yourself a Christian. It's okay to be from a Christian background, a Christian culture. I mean, it's our cultural background. That's the deal. So, but what do you call yourself? Believer? Well, even the demons believe. So that doesn't distinguish you, right? What do you call yourself?
Wait a minute. I've never heard that. You know, I want to call myself a believer, but even the demons believe.
Yes, that doesn't distinguish you any.
Yeah, right.
Or if you call Jesus the Christ. Jesus said there are many Christs. So what are we doing here? So I kept narrowing it down, and finally I realized I grew up in a Christian culture that basically pointed me toward Jesus, but I never bought it at that point. Then I came to understand who Jesus was, submitted to him, and now I call myself, my wife calls herself, we call ourselves followers of Jesus. If we go anywhere in the world, that's not a problem. They look at you kind of funny. Wait a minute. Are you here to convert me or what? But once you say Christian, you've turned off half the world.
You have, because of the baggage.
Yeah. And see, Christian didn't really start until the man-made Christianity started in 325 at the council. And it was started by Constantine and that world. So in a lot of ways.
All force.
Yeah, all force, exactly. And so to me, that's a comfortable way to go. I'm a follower of Jesus. You know, we got a call one time from a Buddhist who said, the Dalai Lama would like to have you come and speak on his platform in Northern California and represent Christianity. And it's going to be in front of 750 clerics from all over the world, Muslim, Buddhist, everybody. So I said, wow. And, of course, I wanted the gig, but I knew I didn't represent Christianity very well. So I said to him, you know, I don't know. I'd love to be there. I just like to be there. He said, well, I'm asking you if you'll come and represent Christianity. We don't have many to do that. I said, I don't represent Christianity very well. He said, you don't? I said, no. He said, well, what do you represent? I said, well, I'm just a stubborn follower of Jesus. That's really what it's come down to. He sat there for the longest time. I thought, I'm losing this gig for sure. I know this is over. And then he said, I think that's better. I said, so do I. So I got to be one of the 14 speakers at this event in Northern California with 750 clerics from all over the world talking about compassion and love, you know, that sort of thing. So they never introduced me. They never introduced me. I mean, I had the 3 hours they talked about love, and then they had the speakers. I was the 14th speaker, and I could see I was going to be the last speaker. Well, you know what that means. I'm going to get a standing ovation no matter what I say because they got to stand up. So I am scared to death what I'm going to say. I have no idea. And so finally they introduced me. I walked up, and I said, Jesus hadn't been mentioned the whole day by anybody, by a Catholic priest, by Houston, the church history guy, none of them. They mentioned Christ a lot, but never mentioned Jesus. And I said, I bring you greetings in the name of Jesus. I tell you, it was like I had just put upon them a charismatic experience in that whole audience.
Really?
It went silent. My wife was sitting next to a guy who has a cult vineyard of $650 a bottle, and she learned all about that there, but never told him that I was one of the speakers because she was afraid I might screw up, I'm sure. She's very, very loyal, loves me dearly, but she played her cards well. So I said, bring you greetings in the name of Jesus. It's only right that Jesus is here. He has no hurdles to jump over. He's all-inclusive. Now, how many times have you ever heard anybody as a Christian saying, Jesus is all-inclusive? No, he's exclusive. But I'd never said it before either.
Yeah, he belongs to us only.
That's
our
right.
Private,
he's our guy.
Our private entity.
So I said, he's not owned by anybody, not by any Christian or Christianity. It's only right that he's here. He's all-inclusive. He'll work with anybody. Well, they were blown away. You could just see it. So then I went on to say, in following Jesus, I've realized something. Jesus would not say what the world needs now is love. Well, that's all we've talked about for 3 hours. And the Dalai Lama looked over his interpreter, and he leaned over. I could tell he was confused. What did he just say? And so the guy told him, and you could see the consternation on his face. And he said, I said, what Jesus would say is what the world needs now is more lovers. Like a big, deep sigh. And I said, it's just like you, Your Highness. You were a friend with Imam Khorasani. Because of that friendship, we're having this humongous thing today. You acted out. It's love in action. Everybody went crazy. They're clapping. They're going nuts. And so I spoke a little further. Let me give you a blessing from Jesus just while we're here. And they're eager now. It's just the weirdest thing. I said, may Jesus give you the peace that only God could give in your hearts. May Jesus give you the sense of joy that you could only get through that. May Jesus give you a sense of courage and hope that we can change the world together. May Jesus tie us together into a movement that can make a difference in our world. And then they went nuts, nuts, standing ovation.
And these are Muslims and Buddhists.
Mostly Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews. Everybody was there. So I got to show Jesus off a bit that way. Then after they sat down, I said, if there are 5 birds sitting on a log and 3 decide to fly away, how many are sitting on the log? Now, they're starting to think. Some are starting to speak out. And I said, 5. Just because you decide to fly away doesn't mean you're going to fly away.
Right.
So just because you're excited, you jumped up and down, said, this doesn't mean you're going to do it. But are you going to do it? And I turned the corner right there. It was so. This is when my wife finally said, that's my husband. And so we got invited to the vineyard. We spent time with him. But he heard of a Jesus like that. He came up to me and said, I've never heard Jesus like that. He said, according to you, Jesus trumps everything. I said, I like that. I'm going to use that the rest of my life. And I have. So it was an opportunity out of fear, because that's when I do my best work. I didn't know exactly what to say, but I lifted up Jesus. And no one had a problem with him at all. So that kind of thing those experiences have just catapulted us further into just lifting this person, Jesus, up.
Well, you know, I think you just explained how the simplicity of Jesus can change the world.
Yes.
I mean, it may be simple, but there's nothing more powerful.
That's right.
Nothing, because we're talking God here, for crying out loud.
Exactly.
You know, we're not talking small potatoes.
No.
I'm gonna take us a little bit different direction. I wanna go, because people are really interested, or will be by the time they hear this, in the video series.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to get into that just a little bit.
Sure.
But let's take a quick break first. Hi, this is Charlie Hedges with the next chapter with Charlie, and glad to have you with us. And today, we are privileged and excited to have with us Tim Timmons, who's talking about being a follower of Jesus. And we are now going to talk about the Netflix series that came out last month. And once again, this is September 2019, so it came out August 2019. And it's called The Family. And there are some controversial parts to it. It's a very powerful and influential group. It has significant influence in Washington, D.C., with congressmen and presidents. And the video shows really wonderful things about the family and its dedication to Jesus. But then it also has some questionable things, so I think it's a fair video. But I'd like to ask Tim, since he's been an integral part of the family and close with Doug Coe, who is a leader, to describe a bit reality as opposed to a documentary. And it doesn't mean the documentary is bad, but this is a firsthand experience. So Perhaps we might begin with describing the family and its invisible form of leadership and influence. He compares it with different groups that have invisible forms of leadership, yet that are so powerful. I mean, you know, he could walk in to see a president, and you know, there's power in that.
Yeah.
And so tell me about this invisible leadership and its influence on the world.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to say it. Doug Coe had the opportunity to meet every leader in the world because he was the driver of the what they called the Fellowship at that time, I think.
Okay.
He was the driver for Admiral Verratti, who started this whole thing, to come and pray for people in Washington. The prayer breakfast started with Eisenhower.
Right.
And so every president since then has come to the prayer breakfast. A couple of times we thought they wouldn't, but they did. And they always speak. Very interesting. Always have a different speaker outside the president. And the Congress or the Senate, they change off every year who runs it, who leads it. They pick the music, they pick the speaker, that sort of thing. Anyway, it's all by invitation only. And so it's not invited by any organized group, but like we have the privilege of inviting anybody we want.
Each individual will invite another individual.
You can, and then it's got to go before, can they get in? There's usually some kind of quota, especially in countries. How many? Because in countries, they come free. We fly them in, the whole thing. But in the United States, you still have to have a quota. How many could come from California? How many can, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
So they do have that. The invisible nature, though, is this. There was never, ever, 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 ever any thought of changing a government or changing any other policy in a government. Doug could pick up the phone and talk to any president in the world anytime, and they would listen as a friend. And he taught that if we would be friends with these people, pray with them. And of course, with Muslim world, they want to pray. they're all about praying. Kind of an interesting little deal. But the invisible nature would be that there was never any agenda, no political agenda ever. The only agenda we had was to introduce people to Jesus and small groups. That was the deal.
And yet in the video, they try to say there is policy that they try to say anti-abortion and
right.
anti-
which never happened.
LGBTQ.
Which never happened. Never, ever, ever happened. There's a chart in there. The chart of kind of a skull
yes,
and bones
yes,
chart.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
These are the guys.
Yeah, it looked like it was from the 16th
century.
Oh,
it's unbelievable. Yeah. For 32 years, I spent a lot of hours with Doug Coe. Traveled around the world, the whole thing. I was on the inside, I guess you'd say, right? If there is an inside. Nothing to join. Our nonprofit is separate from that nonprofit. I just felt like I didn't want to be part of some organization, so I didn't. And Doug would always say, we don't have an organization. But they really did, you know, when you got a lot of people. So, but I never saw that chart. Chart didn't exist. It was made up by Jeff Charlotte, who wrote the book. I read the book years ago, and the book is much more negative than the film series. So I wasn't expecting much of anything, although they did come out with videos of Doug in Africa. No one knew where it was, but where he spoke a lot in Africa. And Doug just didn't, he was never in front of the camera much. He was never, that was never part of his deal. His whole thing was, we're friends. Anything you need, let us know. We're there to help you as a friend. I went to Paraguay when the president of Paraguay had just come to know Jesus in a personal way. And three or four of his other cabinet members also did. And so I was asked if I would go down to Paraguay. And they had a group from the fellowship and a group from Campus Crusade. Well, I had worked in both. So they asked me to be the referee between the two and lead the group down there. It wasn't a pleasant time.
No.
So I went down, but went down with a congressman, Congressman Aderholt, Robert Aderholt of Birmingham.
Right. He was in the film.
Yes. And what an amazing man. So different ones tried to get off track in the conversation of things that don't matter. We don't talk about that. We don't know what you're doing in the country. That's nice to hear, but we're not here to make any difference. Aderholt was spectacular. He spoke out. It was my first trip to be with a congressman. He said, folks, let me explain something. We're here to talk about what we think can change the world, and that is following the person of Jesus and learning how the dynamics of small groups work around studying that person of Jesus. That's why we're here, period. That's it. Well, I mean, it shut down all sidetracks. All anybody else wanted to argue about anything. He was just clear as could be. Anytime I ever travel with any of the congressmen, senators, ambassadors, there was never any agenda thing, ever. Just now, somebody, I didn't go on all trips, so somebody might have tried something, but it was never part of the fellowship to ever change that. We had one guy who was the most powerful, still to this day, I think, one of the most powerful Christians in Asia. He's out in Nepal. He had more access to people throughout Asia than anybody I've ever met in my life. He came to Doug thinking Doug had all this power to change policies and laws, and he kept being thrown in jail in India. So for his Christian stance, he said, can you help me to change the law here in India? He said, we don't change laws. What are you talking about? He said, well, they don't want me talking about Jesus out on the streets. And so Doug said, do you like going to jail? And Charles said, well, no. That's why I'd like to change the law. He said, what I'd suggest is don't go teaching out on the streets. Don't violate their law. So Charles said, well, what would I do? He said, what would Jesus do? Now we're on to something. And so Charles said, well, I don't know what he would do. Maybe you get to know a few. Yeah, might get to know two or three people. Maybe you'd pray about it. Yeah. So Doug just kind of went along with it. The guy never came back for a year. Charles didn't, because he knew he didn't know the answer and didn't know where to find it and didn't know how to change Doug. Finally, he came back and said, okay, let me ask you this. What would you do if you were in India and you wanted to really reach out to the Indians and bring the message of Jesus? Doug said, you know what I'd do? I would go to their assembly, their parliament, that sort of thing. I'd walk around and I'd pray and I'd look around. I'd try to meet people, just one-on-one, just meet people and ask questions. Learn about their culture. Learn more about that. He said, but that's going to take a long time. He said, well, not as long as your jail sentences are. I mean, so finally, Charles relented and said, okay, I'm going to go this route. What happened? He started meeting then heads of state. He started meeting people and talking to them about Jesus. They weren't opposed to Jesus. They were opposed to people coming into their country and converting others.
Right.
And, you see, culturally converting and making them Western Christians.
Yes, it's not just a faith system. It's a whole cultural
change. So Charles changed. Charles began to have favor like he's never had favor before throughout all of Asia. That's the kind of thing that we dealt with there. There was just never any interference. Now, in the documentary, they act like, oh, that's there. And they use something I think is interesting. Doug pointed this out to me when we read the book together. I'd read it. He read it years ago. And he said, you know, when they say private, when we say private, they say secret. I said, yeah, good point. When we say private, I don't share with people the person I counsel with today at lunch.
Right.
I don't share that. That's private.
Right. Right.
But it wasn't secret, you know.
Right. And right. Secret has this conspiratorial
sort of
connotation.
And
to
that's
it.
The way Jeff went. The other thing Jeff did, Jeff Charlotte, the author, is Jeff has trouble, as a lot of people do, with forgiveness. We would take a David, King David, adulterer, murderer, and that he put Uriah in the front lines, and then he was forgiven, a man after God's own heart, and we would hold him up as he's our hero. Well, Charlotte would say, wait a minute, how can any group say that David is your hero? Well, he missed the point over and over and over. Then they had guys, modern-day people, who had sinned and confessed it, and came to the group and talked, and they offered forgiveness, the whole kind of thing. Some violated that, but still, that sense of forgiveness is a hard thing for people. There's nobody in the Bible, as you know, there's no one in the Bible, maybe Joseph. I mean, I can't find too much against Joseph, but...
Well, it's because there's only 4 sentences on him.
Well, so. Yeah. Not that Joseph. No, I'm talking about the Joseph with the many colors.
Oh, that Joseph.
I mean?
Oh.
He didn't do many things wrong. I mean, I've searched for sin. He's probably going to be upset with me when I see him someday. But you can't find many characters in the Bible that didn't have flaws. We believe that's normal. That's natural. That's who people are. Now, how do we work through that? Boy, that bothers Jeff Charlotte. We want to keep it pure and simple. Well, you do that, you're going to have a very small crowd because you only have perfect people come. You don't have much to talk about, you see.
Well, yeah, except there are religious groups that will say...
That's right.
That will say we are sinners, but they don't act like it.
No, that's right.
If a genuine sinner walked in their doors, you know, if an alcoholic walked in,
yeah.
You know...
Yeah.
That would not.
So those are the two big things I found in the book and the film. Although I was very pleased that they allowed other people to speak, Zach Womp of Tennessee, Larry Ross, who's a PR guy, really articulate, Mark Siljander, he told a story I didn't think he was going to tell, how that he and Doug went in private jet into Libya and no passports. No promise of coming out to go meet with Gaddafi, because Siljander was in Congress, voted for the bombing of that killed Gaddafi's daughter, and thought he could meet with him. They could pray with him. Well, the number one guy met with them. And so on their way out, he said, I got to tell him. So he tells the guy, the reason why I came is I wanted to ask forgiveness of Gaddafi for that bomb that killed his daughter. And the guy teared up, and Mark was very emotional about the whole thing. And they called him before they left the runway and said, you'll get good news within the next 2 weeks. And they explain all this in there. And Gaddafi got rid of his weapons of mass destruction. I mean, all kinds of things
and
happened.
And he released the two people.
That's right.
Who were accused of the bombing of the Pan Am.
Yeah, Lockerbie, that's right.
Yeah.
So that's how we, on the family side, we would go in and say, well, let's pray together. And I remember when Siljander told the FBI, they came after him years ago and said, what are you doing with this guy over here? I don't understand what you're doing with this crazy guy over here. Well, we prayed together, and this one FBI guy just pounded his fist on the table and said, there's no way in hell you were praying with him. You know, they just don't get it. But we live in another world, we live in another kingdom, and we practice that the best we can. Not perfectly, but we practice it the best we can.
Yeah, something I've been impressed with that's impacted me in this talk is we just want to be friends.
Yeah.
I like that.
Isn't that great?
You know, that is you were talking about South Coast Community Church, it's an attitude. There was an attitude.
Mm-hmm.
There was an attitude of friendship and acceptance and forgiveness, and that we're all in the same boat together.
You're welcome.
And right? we need help, and that help comes in the name of Jesus.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that was quite simple. I've got a closing question for you here is going to be easy for you to answer. I am convinced that you could once again be a lead pastor of a 20,000 person church. I mean, you are, I've heard you several times as a public speaker, and in my mind, you're the best public speaker I've ever heard. You have a charisma that draws people to you. So you could be the 20,000 person out there. You could be the Joel Osteen or Rick Warren or one of those guys if you wanted to be. But it seems to me that you've elected to follow a different route as a follower of Jesus. Can yes. you explain to me why you would give up such, you know, it's like Jesus' temptations,
yeah,
you know?
That's right. No, and that is it. I think that's where it is, popularity, things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
What I came to believe and understand through Jesus, encouraged by Doug and others, but through Jesus, that Jesus always worked with small groups. It was the power of the few. Communists stole it from him. They started doing cell groups all over the world, changed the world in their way. So I started thinking, if I could get to more people by spending time with a few, then that makes sense. Well, of course it does. So I love the idea of speaking before 35,000 people or whatever. But and if they paid you, that was even better. You know? we just were committed, so committed. I started saying to the church before we shut this one church down, we dismantled it. We didn't shut it. We dismantled it. I said, you know, I just see a big living room. I can see it now. And these people thought I was nuts. And so I see them living, and we're just sitting around having coffee, just enjoying ourselves, and we're interacting over truth. Well, finally, after I did six series of six messages, and then finally we had a retreat, and I said, it's over. We're going to the living room. And people were just shaken. They couldn't believe it. I was giving all that up. Now I speak to more people every day. Through my podcast and blog, I speak to more people every day than I ever would in a megachurch. And we were called one of the first megachurches in the United States.
We were one of the first.
Exactly.
Us in Willow Creek. Yeah.
So we basically, I realized we can talk to more people that way. So I'm influencing more people by having a few get it, and then that few pass it on, etc. So we have people all over the world who we call dangerous disciples who have bought into it. They're not buying into me. You know, something else you probably don't know. I'm giving all my podcast material away to people in other countries, in other languages, for them to translate into their language so that they become the star podcaster of that country. The first one is in West and Central Africa. Pastor Cujo has had it translated into French. He's got 75 podcasts all about the principles of Jesus. He is so excited. He can't wait to now translate everything else. My thinking is, if we can get more and more people to do that, because I got so much material, they'll never mention me. One of our friends who used to be on our staff, he said, "You know how you're going to know when you're successful?" I said, "No, tell me. I'd like to know." He says, "When somebody takes your material and uses it and doesn't give you credit for it."
Right.
I said, "Yeah, that's true persuasion." He said, "You got it."
And that's also true humility.
Yeah, well.
You know, I know you want to shy away from that personally, because it's, you have to be, a true great leader has to be a humble leader.
Yeah, for sure.
And a humble leader has to be able to accept that kind of thing, that their face is not attached to everything.
Yeah, exactly.
That goes on. And with most of the mega churches, the big guy, their face is attached.
Oh, not invented here syndrome is a big problem in our world, you know? And if we could get over that and just be about Jesus and his principles, to me, it just frees up everything. It frees up everything.
So let me close with this, Tim. You are obviously so passionate about Jesus and other people finding hope, resolve, and love and attachment with God. Where does this come from? You know, what drives you to do this? Is it a call? Do you feel that God has called you to do this specifically and make this kind of difference? What's driving you?
I think what drives me is, once I start to understand what's real and what's not so real, is I say it a lot at the end of letters, advancing the conversation of Jesus and his kingdom. That's what I do. And I realize I can't convert anybody.
Well, you've always believed that. You've always told us that.
I got credentials now. I know. Because Jesus says no flesh and blood can do that. So why are you doing that? I was told I could convert the world. Well, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So introduce them to Jesus and let that conversation happen. And I'm convinced then they get changed. Introduce them to the kingdom and they find freedom. To me, that's more exciting than anything I could ever imagine being part of. So I live, eat, sleep, think, drink, all about how do we advance the conversation of Jesus and the kingdom.
I love that, advancing the conversation of Jesus. Simplicity will change the world.
That's right.
Tim Timmons, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charlie.
It's been a great pleasure having this conversation. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning into The Next Chapter with Charlie. And be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.